the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This week, the MJA has published a supplement called Building a Sustainable Rural Physician Workforce, which identifies five themes facing doctors who wish to work rurally, as well as the consequences for patient outcomes. Those themes are characteristics of the existing rural workforce, the professional identity of that workforce, the salient features of the rural training context for trainees, the context, experiences and intentions of supervisors, and the eight principles to guide future efforts.
If we leave the medical workforce as it is at the moment, we are going to get stellar performance from that health service in certain areas, but we are going to leave a large amount of our population behind with easily preventable and avoidable harm that will come to them because of the distributional issues that underlie our workforce.
That was Professor Jennifer May, the Director of the Department of Rural Health at the University of Newcastle, talking about the maldistribution of the rural workforce in this country. Professor May and Professor Tony Scott, a health economist from the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research, are the authors of an editorial published by the MJA to accompany the Building a Sustainable Rural Physician Workforce supplement. Professors May and Scott are my special guests today. Thank you both for doing this. Rural health, or more specifically the maldistribution of the rural workforce, I guess, is what we're talking about. What's clear to me is, as I have ongoing conversations with people, is that this is not simple. It's not a quick fix.
From my point of view, it's taken 20 years to get here, and it's 20 years of unintended and intended policies, and it is mainstream and some of the rural fix policies in combination. So it's no surprise that it's taken us a long time to get here, but I think it also means we have to be very realistic about what the road is ahead to get to where we want to go.
When you say to get here, how do you define here? Is here a good place or is here a bad place?
Well, from my point of view, as a living and working in rural Australia, it's a not very good place at all. Mm. It feels a little like I'm getting close to the top of the cliff, and that is that the ageing of our rural workforce is very obvious, and the scope of practice of that rural workforce, both in terms of general practice and in terms of specialists, and the generalist nature of the work that they have done is not being replaced. In that sense, I think we're sitting in a very difficult place, and it's certainly a place that if I project 10 years forward, I don't see the workforce there to take it on.
I mean, it's also kind of, you know, the 20 years is important kind of milestone because it's around the time that they started to expand all the medical school places and new medical schools. It's around that time. And yet, you know, only last year was the rural generalist pathway for GPs introduced after years of build-up and work. And so, and that's a fundamental thing to happen because it changes a training pathway. A lot of the other fundamentals haven't changed, I don't think, in that time. And the Commonwealth can only do so much because of the Federation and all the different stakeholders involved. And I think it requires a big push to kind of really change things and change the culture of training and the nature of training on a much bigger scale, I think, that's been done today.
Is that something new that we're saying, though? Haven't we been saying that for 20 years?
I think that's a very, very reasonable point. But I think what Tony's suggesting is that, in fact, the policy responses have only come of recent times. Yep. And that was what I was saying. It's a combination of mainstream policy failure and rural health policy failure and their intersection. So the policies that we have put in place since we had that doubling in the number of medical students have really served to increase the number of doctors, but the distribution of those doctors and the training that they have undertaken has been 2-to-1 towards specialist and subspecialist occupations as opposed to the more generalist streams. Consequently, the downstream impacts of that have been greater difficulty in rural and regional areas, particularly in the physician area, to provide clinicians with the depth of and scope of practice suitable to more rural practice.
Tony, you were going to say something?
Yeah, look, I think as well, you know, with the expansion of graduates, I think everybody's just been trying to trying to catch up with that a bit. You know, there was a whole hoo-ha about, well, will they all get intern jobs a few years ago? Then will they all get specialist training places and where they're going to go? So we've got to send them to the private sector. Let's send them out of the cities to try and train because we've got no capacity in the cities to train them. Yep. There's only so many supervisors, so many accredited places. And so the policies have been trying to just accommodate this group of people coming through without changing the fundamentals of the training at the same time, you know? So you've, without changes to incentives, changes to training pathways, which should have started a long time ago, these people are going to get stuck and they're going to get a lot of junior doctors now. You say to them, what's happening? And say, well, you know, I'm actually looking at alternative careers.
Yeah.
Because I know I'm not going to get a job in my preferred specialty. And so that's going to generate a lot of waste, actually. You know, people who aren't in the job that they want, aren't working at the top of their skill set, and yet we still have need in rural areas and in other areas for doctors.
Yeah. So not only do we have a shortage of generalist doctors in the bush, but we also have a glut of junior doctors who can't find work.
Yeah, and you know, the a lot of these doctors are looking for alternative careers, don't want to leave the city, want to stay in the city, and no matter what you do, they're not going to leave the city, right? So that's why it's all then about, well, back to, well, who do you select for medical school? Where do you put them in training? And it's not in cities. It's got to be outside of cities. And how do you get them connected to these rural communities that they're going to go back after training? And that's something that the people are working on. There's been a lot of work to do that. But but it's, again, it's a bit all over the place.
So I think that we know where what success looks like in bits. We have succeeded, I think, in heading on some of the elements of selection, but probably not in enough quantity to impact. So if 30% of students are selected of rural origin into medicine, we can expect only 30% of those to return. That gives us 10%. So the issue is about quantum. We've got that 10% stream, but we really need 30% of our medical practitioners to choose to live and work in rural areas if we're going to mirror the geographic distribution of the population. So how do we get those other 20% to change their tune? And as I said, I think we do know quite a little bit about a selection, and the specialist colleges are starting to take on selection processes that do start to advantage the qualities and attributes, which include rural exposure and rural practice. So there is movement there. We are moving some training to rural and regional areas, but I think the bigger issue is we suffer from this generalism malaise where through medical school, through junior doctor training and into specialist training, that we do perceive generalism as a lower order specialty. We give it less status, we give it less financial remuneration because procedural practice and tertiary high volume procedural practice is the most advantaged financially in the sector. And as consumers, we have been educating people that subspecialist practice is superior. And so it's with little doubt that they also are choosing to bypass generalism in the pursuit of what they are being told and perceiving is a higher worth situation, being specialism or subspecialism.
Is that misperception of generalism the fault of the educators? Is it the fault of the government's lack of proper financing of GP and generalism?
I think laying blame is not helpful. As I said, I think I'm very keen to actually name the issues directly so that we start working on them. And I think there is no doubt that as we have become more urbanised as a country, and as we continue to, and Tony alluded to it, and a lot of the Mabel work will demonstrate, that people are very place-based, and many graduates who live in urban areas would not change their location for 65% or 165% more money. Yeah. So there are those geographic distributional factors which are welding a large number of people to an urban location, and their training and their exposure follows that.
And I mean, I think as well, this happens in a lot of countries in the UK, Canada, US. It's the same thing between generalists and specialists, that, you know, the generalists are going to earn less and have fewer kind of prospects for career advancement. And I think that's the thing as well. You know, we did some work on Dr. Zernings a while ago using NABLE data. And, you know, with non-GP specialists who generally, you know, work in public hospitals as well, there's a career structure. Yes. It's like, you know, you've got increments on the salary scale. The more experienced you are, the more you're paid. Where GPs, once you get fellowship, it's flat. There's no rewards for staying in the longer term. And people look at those, they look ahead at those career paths. You know, the remuneration is part of that. Will I, you know, as I get more experience, will I get more pay? And as a GP, you kind of don't, right? Unless you do other things. We've got to think more about, it's a career pathway in terms of a track, but it's also a track where at each stage you get more respect, more reputation, more kind of earnings as well. And that doesn't exist in general practice right now.
How do we tell juniors and students that actually you might find this really quite satisfying?
So I think that's the exposure story. You need to walk the walk and get out there and experience. And there is quite a lot of evidence now that exposure needs to be longitudinal. And when I say longitudinal, I don't mean visiting every so often. I mean, it's probably at least 6 months, possibly 12 months. And this is important because if we think about rotating, specialist training programs rotating, probably those terms need to be 6 months as opposed to 3 months if there is going to be significant community immersion. I also think that it is the lot of most of us to want to say we're satisfied and that our wanting others to validate our decisions. What I would suggest to you is that the other question is, what is the opportunity cost of living where you live? And for most of us, that is an opportunity cost that we have measured and we have decided falls on the side of living rurally. But that includes changes in educational opportunities for children, spousal employment, and a whole lot of and proximity to family, which may or may not be close by. And it's those opportunity costs that probably feed into the satisfaction level that we're talking about.
I'm chatting with Professor Jenny May and Professor Tony Scott about solving the long-standing problem of the maldistribution of Australia's medical workforce. Their editorial is available at mja.com.au, where it is free to access. The MJA supplement their editorial supports is also available at mja.com.au and is also free to access. If you haven't heard the big news already this week, the MJA's journal impact factor has increased to 7.738, the highest we've ever recorded, and a big increase from last year. Apart from giving all of us here at the MJA a warm and fuzzy feeling, it's an important indicator to all you potential authors out there. Publishing with the MJA will benefit your citations and your work. If you'd like to see how to publish with us, check out the MJA instructions to authors. You'll find them by going to our homepage at mja.com.au and clicking on the tab called For Authors. Let's get back to our chat with Jenny and Tony. Is that satisfaction level harder to reach in rural communities?
I don't know if it's harder to reach. I think to an extent, you know, people make a choice, go there and then say, yeah, I'm happy. I made the choice, you know, they're in control. And if they made a choice to go in the cities, they might be equally as satisfied because they made that choice. It's not necessarily a kind of causal effect, but nevertheless, it just shows that with exposure to training and going to rural area, you can lead a good, fulfilling life. And I think it's kind of one of those things where those things have to be emphasized. I mean, people do make these choices and they make trade-offs when making these choices, as Jenny said, and it's often that prior exposure or actually just living with a community that really nails it for kind of many, many rural doctors.
So what's the state of play at the moment? Do medical students have to go and do a rotation in the bush?
There's a program that the Commonwealth runs called the Rural Health Multidisciplinary Training Program. It supports both rural clinical schools of all the major universities, but also university departments of rural health. So there is a real understanding that what we're talking about is recruiting doctors, nurses and allied health practitioners, because no longer do people want to work on their own and solo, but they absolutely want to work in an environment where they're supported and part of a team. So 25% of medical students need to spend 25% of their training time in rural areas under the RHMT program and are supported by the Commonwealth to do that.
Does that need to be more than 25%? Given that you say we need 30% of more people to go out bush.
So if we're concentrating on that rural origin and as the primary predictor of rural return, then I think the first question is, should we be aiming at only allowing into medical school 50% of students who'd lived in a rural and regional area as opposed to 25%? So if we're talking about predictive factors, then that selection one is a big one. Yes, I believe that the more students that are exposed, but it has to be a positive rural exposure, not just an exposure, not just a tick in a box and an exposure with a disillusioned, overworked, burnt out practitioner. In the main, there is no doubt that positive rural exposure is the second greatest predictor of rural return. We're certainly interested in exposing metropolitan students as well as rural students to that experience, because many of us, and myself is one, are rural converts who grew up in the city.
But I think it also highlights just how much, it's not just getting a body out there, it's about when they get there, having a lot of support out there, rural clinical school to support their learning, great peers and mentors and supervisors, and that requires a lot of investment too, to kind of, I mean, in some ways, you know, the kind of stars have to align for this to happen, but it requires more than just getting people out there.
Well, you need a model of a functional health system, because what you're wanting to do is to show students what a satisfying and productive career they can have. So to the extent that the locations have a quality rural training base, and many, many of them do, then it is highly likely that that can be built on and will become the positive experience that we're wanting.
So we want students and junior doctors to have positive experiences out in the bush. We want GPs and generalists to have a career pathway that includes remuneration for experience. We want the support for family, spouses, kids, and we want leadership that values generalism. Where have those things got to come from that they aren't coming from now?
In the statement that you've just made, there are multiple stakeholders. And that epitomises our current problem. So the federal government obviously has responsibility for community care, for general practice in general, and also for medical student numbers, and with levers like the RHMT program for distribution, I'd suggest. Obviously our employers, our local health districts, have major responsibility in most of Australia for training. And obviously we have professional specialist training colleges who lead the educational attributes and attainment of fellowship. So it really requires all those three groups to be working en song with communities if we are going to have a functional model of training in the health system. One of the difficulties over time has been the unintended disinvestment by one or other of those organisations, not realising that there are a whole lot of straws on the camel's back, and when they fall out, the service will disappear. So it is no one's full responsibility, but it is all of us have an important part to play. And if we take a concept like generalism, then we need to buy in to the fact that as a workforce and as a medical workforce in general, that we want that to be one of the hallmarks of how we think about our workforce. I have to say to you, right at the moment, I don't think as a medical community we're invested in that vision. So while ever we're not, and we don't see the intrinsic value of treating people as locally as possible, to the widest scope of practice that is available, then I think we are going to struggle. That doesn't mean that regional communities can't work on a hub and spoke model and certainly achieve some of those outcomes. But we're asking for the whole system to pivot and, if you like, to privilege generalism over specialism and privilege training in wide scope of practice areas as opposed to narrow.
Let's talk about the National Medical Workforce Strategy. Where is that at? When is it going to be finalised, and what are your hopes for it?
My understanding is that it is being finalised, but because it is a document that will go both to the federal government and to the states, that there will be a process involved in getting that it needs to travel. It is without doubt that the themes of that medical workforce strategy must include the geographic distribution of our workforce and generalism as a concept, and also the support and well-being of the medical workforce. And I guess the other thing that I would say would be obviously part of it is a need to collaborate on good data. Tony would attest to the value of good data, and unfortunately some of the decision-making that has been made over time has not had the full picture. That is because we have a very distributed system, as we've talked about, in the way and people work across jurisdictions and across the Commonwealth.
And I think as well, we're talking about 20 years. It's 20 years and we've just got a national medical workforce strategy 20 years on since we started this expansion, and it's 20 years too late, to be honest.
Are you confident that it will do all of those things that you need it to do, Jen?
I'm confident it will name them. And I'm confident that much of the impact of the strategy will be around its capacity to influence as opposed to its capacity to mandate. The fact that we're talking about generalism and its importance and wanting to convey that to the medical workforce is incredibly important and incredibly valuable. So that discussion and that discourse is primary to anything changing. And as I said, what we've got to do is look at the value proposition. If we leave the medical workforce as it is at the moment, we are going to get stellar performance from that health service in certain areas. But we were going to leave a large amount of our population behind with easily preventable and avoidable harm that will come to them because of the distributional issues that underlie our workforce.
It's hard to talk about anything to do with health at the moment without mentioning COVID. Is COVID sharpening the focus on this?
COVID has been a two-edged sword. Implicit in some of the work that was done as part of the physician studies is what is the role of virtual care, the health service to the future? And I think we all believe that virtual care has a role. The problem is that we're not very good at the moment about working out where and why it doesn't work. And I would suggest to you as a rural practitioner that it is in acute presentations is one area where it certainly doesn't work. The other problem that we have, which COVID has beautifully identified, is that by privileging virtual care over face-to-face care, which we've had to do, what we have done is inadvertently undermined some of the models of primary care that we have and secondary care. So now it is very easy for me to refer someone to a psychiatrist based in Melbourne and overfly and undermine a local psychiatric service, which would be required when that person presented in the middle of the night with an acute need where face-to-face care might be more important.
The medical workforce strategy scares me a little bit because I wonder if it's going to end up just being another document that, as you say, names the problems but doesn't drive change.
That's because the way that our health system is configured doesn't allow that primary driver to conduct the orchestra. Yeah. I'd suggest to you that the strategy is a child of the organisational structure in which our medical workforce is working. I am confident that it is an agent of change. However, I absolutely accept that unless all the stakeholders buy in, and I think there are some value propositions, both financial and otherwise, that will come to the fore. Mm-hmm. And what I would suggest to you is over the last 4 or 5 years, I've seen significant change in the attitude of the specialist colleges towards rural training. I see a slow but absolutely steady and positive realisation that it doesn't do the college any good to have no practitioners in rural areas and no access of patients to those services. So I do believe, and I'm seeing in selection processes, a real intent to try and measure it up. Interestingly, there's two different approaches that have two different pros and cons. One is, do you obligate a small number of trainees yes. and expect them to do the heavy lifting? Or do we expect all trainees to train in their specialty to the breadth of practice that would allow them to work rurally, and then they can choose to work in an urban area? So there are still some fundamental questions that underlie the way we train, probably need to be discussed more openly so that we can actually get to the nub of the problem. We need to adequately and well resource regional and rural health services. So who wants to come and work in a system where they're not going to get operating time, they're going to be squeezed for this, squeezed for that, and they're not adequate nursing staff at the hospital to work to their scope? The other thing is that increasingly our graduates, our medical graduates in Australia, are not prepared to work the hero hours that some of my colleagues in their 50s and 60s have worked and continue to work. We're going to need to look at better resourcing practitioners so that they can work not at that ridiculous level, but they can be recruited and retained in regional areas. So that takes an injection of resources that will be over and above that involved in training. I think it's very easy to focus on selection and training because they're the front end. But unless we are resourcing and supporting a rural and regionally based health service, it is not an attractive place to work. And our efforts at sensitizing and exposing our young graduates will not reap the benefits to which that we all really want.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.